This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about insomnia with Dan Murray. He's an entrepreneur and fellow podcaster who's recently started a new business all about how we can better support mental health through nutrition to live our most productive lives. And before we get into the interview with Dan, we've got a few stats and definitions. So to start off, from the National Sleep Foundation, insomnia is described as a difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep even when the person has the chance to do so. Is that kind of what you were expecting from that?
Yeah, thought that sounded quite right.
Mm-hmm. For contrast, it's defined by dictionary.com as habitual sleeplessness and or the inability to sleep. And certainly when it's diagnosed as acute, it is generally referring to when you've got that habitual sleepness, where it's night after night struggling to get even a few hours. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly something our guests experienced for a stretch of quite a few months, which had massive effects on his life in general, but also his mental health.
I didn't realise that it was, I'd not put that much thought into it previously, but after doing some of the research and meeting our guests, I didn't realise how much of it was about people waking up also in the night. You know, every time I've thought of insomnia, I kind of have that picture in my head that you can't get to sleep and, you know, you're just lying there and you're up till really late and, you know, all this is going on, as opposed to actually people who do sleep but constantly wake up, can't get back to sleep, or when they do, they wake up again. You know, the disturbed sleep, as well as just not being able to actually drop off. That's something that a lot of people have problems with, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's quite complicated for something that on paper and with its definitions seems very straightforward. There's so many factors in it.
Yeah.
You know, where your mental health in general can influence it. And then if your sleep is affected, yeah, then your mental health gets worse.
Vicious circle.
Yeah.
I think is the term, isn't it? What comes first?
Absolutely. Yeah, chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
And like you say there, often we don't think of waking up in the night and all the other things that can affect your sleep hygiene, like the kind of routine, like having the consistency of time you go to bed, how the amount of light in the morning can change through the year and affect you.
Yeah.
It all plays into it. And one other thing I read up about that I didn't really ever think of was how if people have insomnia bad enough and regularly enough, they can start to associate their bed with wakefulness rather than sleep. And that's something I never really thought of. But in extreme cases where people are regularly having very little sleep, GPs will even recommend that they, to a certain extent, just kind of take a pause, leave the situation, go do something else, and then come back to it.
Yeah.
Because even though that may seem counterproductive, yeah, to getting to sleep,
yeah,
the more they're lying there awake, the less their brain is in this routine of, when I'm in this place, I sleep.
Yeah, and I think, and that surprised me as well, that it was actually something that a GP would talk about or advise you to do. Because I've known when I've not slept very well, I would never, you know, it's a nightmare, excuse the pun, it's a nightmare trying to sleep when you can't, but reading or doing, I'd always try and do something that will make me tired or take my mind off the fact that I'm trying to go to sleep. But then, again, having read up on this, that's the difference between somebody who might not be sleeping very well, like me at times, as opposed to somebody who's got insomnia. Completely, it's not that easy to just, you know, I think, oh, I've had a few bad nights and I've read for half an hour, then I've gone back to sleep. People with insomnia that suffer, it's at the other end of the spectrum to that. Really serious.
And it's funny, you've reminded me of one of the strangely intimate things about podcasts as well, because a lot of people like myself listen to them when either going to sleep or even to get to sleep.
Yeah.
I've been on the record on the podcast before saying that Whoopi Goldberg's book about relationships, which is called If They Say You Complete Me, Run. I've listened to that at times in my life when I've struggled
to
sleep.
I need to read that, Bob. I need to read
it's,
that.
It's so funny, and she's got such a good tone. And also, she has this like really clear voice where you can slow it down to like half speed, and she still sounds relatively normal. And so I can just like drift off to like words I've heard said like 3 or 4 times I've read it before.
Wow.
And so that's like a really kind of reassuring distraction.
So an audiobook.
Because otherwise it's just my internal narrative, whereas actually I can just listen to this and I agree with every word of it.
Wow.
And it's going to send me off. But a lot of people do that with podcasts as well. And you can set it to go to sleep after 10 minutes. So you'll do like 10 minutes and then lie down and then...
Oh, wow. I mean, you've got quite a nice voice that could put me in sleep. That's a compliment.
In the nicest way.
Absolutely, in the nicest possible way. It's calming. But I don't think I've listened to a podcast in the night. But then if you're next to someone in bed, it's probably not. But then you've got headphones. Maybe I'll have to give it a go.
Yeah, well, particularly in our modern technological world, it's kind of one of the few things you can do that does involve a phone or an iPad or whatever, but yet you're not looking at a screen, which is going to keep you up as well.
Absolutely. And I do recommend, actually, those kind of distractions when we're talking about mental health, because lying there with nothing else to think about but your own thoughts that are then just playing over and over and over in your head surely is just never going to help the situation, help you drop off. Just really hard.
Oh, yeah. And I've certainly been around a lot of that in my own family.
Mm.
I have relatives that worry a lot, particularly mothers. It seems to somewhat come with the territory.
Yeah.
Where they'll be up at night worrying about the packed lunch for their kid in 2 weeks' time.
Wow.
And, oh, I don't have any cucumber in. Well, you're going shopping 2 more times before that lunchbox. You'll get some cucumber.
I'm not that bad. Don't get it wrong. I do wake up thinking about the million and one things that I've got to do and run around after my children and all my own life. But yeah, that is a bit extreme. But you do. You wake up thinking, I've got it. They're on a trip tomorrow. Have I done that? Have I got that sorted out? Am I doing that? Oh my goodness, I've got work. It can take over. But you mentioned right at the beginning of this conversation, and I think that's key. We underestimate the power of sleep and the consistency and how important it is to have some kind of routine. Because when you don't sleep, I'm up so late, no wonder that I just don't sleep that well, and then I'm up early in the morning. But when I sleep well, if I go to bed and go to bed, turn off at 11, not let's get into bed and watch Grey's Anatomy, like episode series 6 or whatever.
And that's a risk, because you're going to get to a sad episode and then you'll have to watch 2 more.
Exactly what happened. Someone's died and I'm like, oh my God, I can't end now. I can't go to sleep. But yeah, hilarious.
Yeah, and that's certainly something I'm finding in my old age, that I need my sleep more than ever.
Yeah.
I can do one night maybe on like half a night's sleep, and then anything more, it just kills me. I just can't function like a normal human.
Really?
Yeah, and it really affects my mood. It's definitely a factor in my mental health, 100%.
And mine. And the scary thing about it is, Bobby, I've never, until maybe the last 6 months, acknowledged or even been conscious that that's been what it is. Until I've struggled and had to really, like, think about my life and what's going on, have I thought about symptoms or things that I'm doing that might be adding to this sleep and all different things that are going on with me? And I think if more people are actually conscious and aware of how important sleep is, because I could run off hardly any hours for 3 nights in a row and not wonder why at the end of the week I'm just a complete mess.
Mm-hmm.
But if I sleep well, it's like with anything, isn't it? When you're fitting well and you're feeling healthy, you don't think about why am I fitting well and feeling healthy. When you're not feeling well, you start thinking about all the variables and all the things that might add to that. And I think sleep's one of those things. I've had a great week of sleep. I feel great. And I don't then sit and think, well, why am I feeling great? Oh, I just get on with my life. But, you know, I sometimes think, Dan, you are knackered. And it's because you went to bed at 3 o'clock, 3 nights on the trot, and woke up at 7. And did a million things throughout the whole day.
It makes such a difference. I used to, particularly when I was a teen and I was in sixth form, I just needed so much sleep, partly because of that life stage you just do.
Right.
But also, it was just so overwhelming. You know, I was around so many people at school. I was working like a weekend job. I was like constantly extroverting.
Right.
And you know, I would find at times my mood getting really bad and I'd be feeling really low and depressed. And a lot of the time it would be just symptoms piggybacking off my exhaustion, that I was kind of let my defenses down by not sleeping. And then the depression was riling up.
Yeah.
And so I would pretty much have times where I'd prescribe myself sleep. I'd be like, you need a nap. There's nothing else to be doing with you. Go to bed.
Really?
You're not achieving anything.
And could you go and nap?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had to practice, you know, the right amount of time you can sleep.
Yeah.
Before you wake up feeling like a zombie.
It's such a funny thing. It seems universal. Everybody's like, my other half. And he's always like, Dan, do not let me sleep longer than 20 minutes. And sometimes I think, but you just looked so comfortable and I didn't want to wake you up. But then he's just a nice...
You're so cute when you're asleep.
Yeah. But for the rest of the afternoon, he can't function. Zombie's the word.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's funny that is. Everybody says that, I think, as well. And he can nap for... I've got 7 minutes in between clients, he'll say. So go and get in his car or somewhere quiet and put his alarm for 7 minutes.
That's psychopathic.
Oh my goodness. Literally, and be gone in 30 seconds, have 7 minutes and wake up right as rain. Napper. King napper. I never nap.
No, I take at least the amount of time I slept to recover from the nap. I feel better afterwards, but if I take 20 minutes, I need 20 minutes to feel conscious again. Then I feel great.
Yeah.
And... you know what? I have another stat here. We are not alone. According to the Great British Sleep Survey of 2012, they looked at 13 different countries and found that those living in the UK are the most exhausted, with over a third, 37%, saying they don't get enough sleep. And that's at one time. So I wonder, throughout a year, how close to 100% might have ticked that box if they'd been asked that day.
Yeah. But what surprises me is why are we at the top of the list? All the countries are going through the same...
Well, we need to have siestas. That's the answer.
That is the absolute answer. That's what we need. Everything needs to shut down at 2 p.m.
Well, it's
until
like
5.
The hot weather we've had recently. It's not just a case of how warm it's been and people not being used to it. It's the fact that there's no aircon in people's homes.
Yeah.
It's the fact that people aren't used to... being more exhausted from the heat. They're not used to having to up their water intake so much. They're not used to having to stock the fridge with ice cubes. Like, we're just not prepared for it.
We're not prepared for any extreme weather,
are we? I'm great with hot weather when I'm on holiday. You know?
Yeah.
When I'm in someone else's country that's prepared for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so to rush through a few more sleep stats from the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. And it's not just people's work. They also found chronic short sleep duration, so that's less than 6 hours, and poor sleep quality may be associated with increased risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cognitive impairment, struggling to think essentially, mental health conditions, neurodegenerative diseases, cancer, and impaired immune function.
Wow.
And the crazy thing is, you look at a cigarette packet, and the kind of things that can increase your risk for.
Yeah.
It's not so dissimilar. It's a lot of the same things.
Yeah. Sleep, people. Go to sleep.
Listen to the rest of the podcast, then have a nap. Yeah. That's what we're saying.
Yeah. Because we will be.
Yeah. Rate and review the podcast, then sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the final one, insomnia symptoms are the most common expression of mental health conditions in the UK, regardless of gender, age, location, or ethnicity.
Yeah, that's not a surprise.
Yeah, and that's something that we often talk about, the link of how lack of sleep can affect your mental illness. And we did a previous episode not so long ago all about sleep. But that's important to highlight. It goes both ways. That actually it's such a common symptom across the board, whatever mental illness you may experience.
Yeah, which is why some things may go unnoticed. And matching with the stat about our country and over a third of us not getting enough sleep, you speak to somebody else and say you're not sleeping and they'll probably say neither am I.
And it is very normalised.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of a larger problem of lack of self-care in people's lives.
Yeah.
That we've got so many other priorities to deal with, friends and family, the workplaces that aren't always the most supportive, so many commitments. You've got Facebook to update, you've got Instagram to update.
Oh,
it seems like more than ever there's a million things we have to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
And so what happens? Well, us looking out for ourselves gets pushed to the bottom of the list. Far too frequently that keeps happening. until you get to a point where you can't cope anymore.
Absolutely. And all our listeners will know, Robbie, that you and I absolutely advocate self-care and that I am a massive exercise fan. Like, it's such a help when you're tired, but you still push yourself and exercise, whether it's a walk or run, whatever that is to you, part of your self-care. But some kind of exercise really does help you sleep. I have to get that in. It really does make a difference to how you feel inside, let alone your physical kind of, like, how tired you are physically, you just want to flake out. But, you know, your hormones, it just changes everything.
And if nothing else, a cold walk when you're struggling to sleep will really make you glad to return to your bed.
It's true.
So with all that said, we'll get into the episode with Dan Murray in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Well, my name is Daniel. My first real understanding of mental health really came as, I guess, an early teen. My grandmother on my mum's side had Alzheimer's, and that was a real journey over 10 plus years, which really struck me because when I was younger, my grandma was the person I used to play with. She's very intelligent. She was a nurse. She was very, you know, very capable, really fun. Well, actually, not that much fun. She was quite strict. But, you know, she was someone I admired a lot. And flip side of my relationship with health in general is worth sharing is my father. He's had terrible health all my life growing up. So I spent a lot of my time in hospital because he had heart attacks and bypasses, and he was blind, and he had all sorts of things, everything that you could possibly have, but they were all on his physical health. And that was kind of part of the course for me growing up, was understanding frailties in physical health. He since passed away. Reality is, a lot of my early exposure to health symptoms came from understanding the physical body, even eyesight. Very unusual, interesting insight for a child to understand the pleasure and joy of having it compared to not having it. My father always had these physical symptoms, and he would bounce back and he'd be much weaker the next time. And, you know, that was a gradual journey over many, many, many years that, you know, slowly eroded. But because he always had his mental health around him, he was always still my dad. And so whatever happened to him, he was always still my dad. But my grandma, she had her physical health, but with Alzheimer's, she just wasn't my grandma anymore, you know. And the slow demise of that happening was far more harrowing than all the things combined that ever happened to my father. And, you know, it's a weird one to sort of compare, like they're in competition, mental health over physical health. But I actually have a really deep insight as a child growing up with two family members I deeply care about, both who've passed away. The only thing that ever truly, I mean, the problem with having a really sick father is you end up getting desensitized. And my dad had a big sense of humor as well about being hospitalized all the time. He, you know, encouraged that kind of behavior towards it. Of all the things that ever happened to him, the only thing that ever really freaked me out, full stop, was 2 to 3 days my dad couldn't communicate with us. And that was like the worst thing I'd ever experienced. And I guess because I was always used to dad being really like frail and ill and not really being able to do anything but being able to talk, like that was always okay. It was only the time when he wasn't able to talk that I like really broke down and lost my, I guess, facade of comfort, knowing that he would get better. And he did get better from that. But I just notably remember in my lifetime, like, the really lasting impressions of what sickness really meant to me.
That makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like you really, through these experiences, got a really good idea of how complex poor mental health can be and how wide-ranging those symptoms can be, so much that they were really changing the personalities of people around you so that they seemed less like your relatives, even.
Yeah, and I think, like, the other thing as well to say about it is, you know, your brain, I mean, obviously, like, I'm spending so much time researching the brain nowadays, but, like, your brain basically controls all your abilities and moods. So with regards to my grandma, she had all of her physical capabilities. She could walk, she could move, she could sit down, she could put herself to bed, she could go to the bathroom. So she had those faculties, but she didn't know who we were. And it was very terrifying for her to meet us again every time, you know, even her daughter, my mum, like meeting someone for the first time and being told they're your daughter is a terribly shocking thing to hear. Because the realization when that lands, it then would freak her out. She was like, wait a minute. Because that's when they're suddenly like, whoa, there's something wrong with me. If you're my daughter, how don't I know that? And the whole thing would play out over and over and over again. It was a harrowing thing to see. You know, it's truly amazing to think about like the kind of impact the brain can have in which different areas.
Yeah. And so for you then, when did you first become aware of perhaps mental illness symptoms or the need to support your own mental health more?
I guess my first experience is that a lot of mental illnesses, you don't really recognize it at the time. It was about a year later where I was like, holy shit, I was depressed because of how fearful I was going into work and feeling so trapped. So I graduated in the recession in 2007 and I went to work in a pub for a year because there were no jobs. And this was after working incredibly hard to get 3 A's at school and a 2-1 at university. And then I graduated and like there were no jobs. So I was like, oh, that's a lot of effort wasted on education. So I went to work in a pub for a year, which I loved, but like ultimately I ended up getting a job in advertising through chatting to someone, him being my local customer and him being impressed with like the way that I spoke to people and offering me an entry job. So it started off well enough, but you know, he treated me extremely badly. He was very threatening. He did crazy things, which I'm saying as I'm not going to name him, happy to share some of the outrageous things to give you some flavor of what I actually mean. But he once invited me to his flat to give me feedback on the day, and he was in the bath. It wasn't a sexual thing, incidentally. It just happened to be that was normal.
Well, he still was being inappropriate. He clearly had very strange boundaries.
Totally. No boundaries. But he was in the bath shaving his head with a dagger and was making these comments about how I needed to improve using the dagger as like a reference point. And it was just horrific. That is not one of the weirder things that he did. And that should help give you some flavor. So in the end, he was so violent and so aggressive. I mean, he had a real problem himself, really bad cocaine problem, as in he was doing it at 8 a.m. every single morning. And it was obvious to everyone in the office, but he was the boss. That I ended up having to get a restraining order on him because he threatened to kill my parents. He used to threaten me over text, so written down evidence of the things that he was threatening me with, which is completely absurd, obviously. So by the time I ended up actually confronting my parents about the relationship I had with my boss and how terrified he made me, thinking, because it was my first job, maybe this is normal, maybe this is like how people psychologically like get you up for better sales or whatever, who knows? They were like, why didn't you tell us about it sooner? This is absolutely crazy, and made me go to the police, which I did, and they ended up getting me a restraining order on him because they said, like, you know, this is so completely inappropriate, it's terrible. So over the course of that year, like, I was so anxious and so terrified. I was working 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and I was earning a 12 grand salary in London. I know. But again, like, the salary's kind of neither here nor there, because regardless, I was living with my parents and I was lucky that I could. And secondly, I was just trying to get on the job ladder, like one way or another. So I kind of didn't care about the money. I cared about the experience. But like the experience of working for really vibed off making me feel terrible, small and terrified all the time. But certainly my first foray into poor mental health. But I only realized it about a year later, as I was obviously consciously always so anxious and concerned and fearful, but I kind of thought that maybe, as a lot of people do, sadly, I kind of thought maybe that's just what professional life is like.
Right.
You know, people genuinely tell themselves that. They say, like, I'm supposed to be miserable, I'm not supposed to enjoy myself. And that is sad fallacy, in my experience.
And sometimes people need that. I've known of plenty of times in my own life where close friends have been getting out of really toxic work environments, but they've had to tell themselves these things so that they can survive until their notice period ends or until they find that new job. You sometimes have to just kind of selectively fool yourself into thinking it's a little bit more okay than it is.
Exactly.
And so how was your sleep at this point?
Well, I distinctly remember, and I always will remember, I started to have dreams that he was in my room. You know, most people dream of the boogeyman or whatever, or have nightmares like that. I literally would wake up and see a shadow at the end of my bed, think it was him and fucking freak out. And obviously there was no shadow and there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that is literally the point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. Because at that point, it'd been like 9 months. And that's when I felt like, okay, this is really manifesting into something. But I seriously need to do something about it. He's a very threatening person. Skinhead, older, grew up like hard people and would always like have calls in the office about like bashing up other people, like in a way that I feel like half those calls are probably fake, made up or whatever, but just done to sort of intimidate. And you kind of had to sort of just laugh them off or whatever because it was weird. So anyway, yeah, about 9 months in, like I started to have these dreams. And that was obviously like my first experience. And then I was fine for many years after that because I left and I worked with nice people who made me feel good about my work and told me I was doing a great job and all the rest of it. So that was fine. He then showed up again 7 years later on Twitter out of nowhere when I was having success. Wow. So went sick in my stomach, pale, so anxious. It was amazing to think, like, psychologically how much power someone can have over you to cause those feelings.
And out of interest with that, when you left the workplace, those feelings of anxiety and the waking up in the night, did that stop pretty immediately?
Yeah,
because that's what I would imagine when you're around someone that is posing such a kind of threat to your safety or perceived safety, because anxiety can't tell the difference.
So that was really quick. That disappeared fast. And then, you know, like when he popped up back again, he basically started to threaten to sue me for defamation. And I was like, I haven't even named you. How can you be talking about defamation? However, you are now going on Twitter and trolling me. And so what I did was I screenshotted all of his trolling and I put it on social media myself and said, this is the stuff that someone is saying about me. He was my first boss. It's obviously not true, but I'm not willing to let him have this power over me. And at that point, he claimed it was defamation. And I was like, no, screenshotting the things you're saying about me is not defamation. It's a reflection, like you're saying them. So we had some good chat about that. And then he threatened to sue me. And fortunately for me, I was running a company at the time and therefore I had lawyers. And they were really lovely people who were like, well, I hate to think about what you're suffering mentally with this exposure, whatever. Like, whatever you need, we'll do it for free. As in, we'll write the letters, we'll take him to court, like, whatever you want. And I was like, frankly, I honestly believe that just a letter of cease and desist, this kind of stuff, would be plenty.
Had the restraining order run out?
Yeah.
And so then when he got that letter from the lawyers, that did stop him, you were saying?
Yeah, he stopped again. Do you know what's crazy? Is 6 months ago, he wrote me a message on LinkedIn saying, all water under the bridge, let's just be friends, like, let's connect. And I just obviously ignored it, because I'm like, why on earth would I allow you into my social network? That's absurd. So as I've grown as a person, I've come from hating him to feeling sorry for him. He obviously genuinely does need help and isn't doing anything about that. It's hard when those kind of things are so embittered and so ingrained in your experience of someone to sort of rise above it psychologically, because it is a psychological scar that person's left on you. But at the same time, part of my job as a human being is to grow and to understand that everyone's different and to understand that, I guess, some of the stuff that he was doing was coming from a place of pain and to have some space to understand that he needs help too. It just should not be me that's trying to help him, that's for sure. So I've definitely grown the capacity to forgive him, which I do, but doesn't mean I want to be his friend. Whenever he contacts me, I mean, I still get that feeling of sick in my stomach, etc. I definitely can't help that.
Yeah, but it sounds like you've really moved on to it in a healthy way. You're not harboring those feelings. It's only then when he's getting back, which is unfortunately part of going through an experience like this. But on the plus side, you're not feeling those feelings permanently. The trauma hasn't stayed to you on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, if we could just backtrack a little bit, when he first did reach out on Twitter that time and you spoke to your lawyers about that, you described how you felt like in the moment feeling sick and that kind of triggering effect. What was it like in the kind of aftermath, the like following days and weeks? How was your mental health?
I couldn't concentrate on anything. It was terrible timing, and he did it on purpose. So we were going through a period of, you know, this is again like mental health scenario with entrepreneurship is timing can be a very strange thing. So I was running a company called Gravel, and on the surface it was doing phenomenally well. But basically It just won an award from TechCrunch, which is this big tech publication,
yeah,
of best mobile app in Europe. And I hadn't turned up to the awards because I was depressed at home. And then so my friend had to pick it up for me, which was really sad because I actually started with my business partner. We started our company being like, wouldn't it be so cool to have TechCrunch love us, blah, 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 blah. Like you always kind of do dizzying lights and all that stuff. And when we actually got nominated, things were going so badly on like behind the scenes that we didn't even have the energy to turn up to the award ceremony. We definitely didn't think we would win because we were telling ourselves we were shit. We did win and we weren't even there at the awards. So that was kind of annoying. But equally, we felt terrible. So that was happening. I also was keynoting at the Wired retail event. I was keynoting in between Google and Facebook. So I'd had this amazing, amazing talking gig that I was just like, I'm like really aspirational. If you'd have asked me 3 years ago, like where would I love to be? I mean, winning an award for TechCrunch and keynoting for Wired retail in between Facebook and Google in the same week, I'd have been like, that's a dream. That's ridiculous. The reality was like everything was like, oh, we've just done a funding round and it'd fallen apart behind the scenes. So we were technically like pretty much trading insolvent because we'd planned everything around this funding round and it all fell through. So I had to get up on stage and deliver this thing in like an inspiring way. Just, this was all at exactly the same time that this guy just came back and started trolling us. And the reason he did it, I think, was because we started to get all this press. We were in Vogue. We were like, and it was all, and I was sharing it on my Twitter, like as you do, right? Kind of like the facade. So it was just like, oh, thank you so much to Vogue for X. Oh, yeah, we won the TechCrunch Europa's way. Oh, hello, I'm keynoting at Wired Retail. And it's something like facade, 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 because you need to. Mm-hmm. That's the game. And also we're mid fucking funding round. So like I really had to. I couldn't be like, we're a piece of shit, because like I would have had to fire everyone. So one way or another, whether you like it or not, you literally have to play that game. And then
Also that's an interesting skill mental health wise as well, that you can really develop this ability to create that mask and to put on a brave face and really oftentimes overcompensate, that you put so much onto the really positive stuff that's happened, because that way hopefully no one will see how you're really feeling, right?
Yeah, and it's all just imposter syndrome. Through obviously through doing that, he then decided to just join Twitter that moment and found all these tweets and just started going at it hard. So the timing of everything was horrific, and I basically went into like a little shell for about 2 weeks afterwards, which was terrible timing because I actually had to sort the company out. Fortunately, my business partner was really like sensitive to the fact of the kind of impact, because I've been friends with him all my life pretty much, so since I was seven. So he was conscious enough to be aware that this guy turning up out of nowhere after a period of time back into my life would definitely have an effect on me. And so he was really helpful.
Yeah.
And I think having someone that can pick up the pieces for you when you are really unable is so important. A key learning for me is like, you know, that companionship.
And I think there's so much power in having someone like that around that understands as well, because one of the things you highlighted earlier that I think is really important is how, particularly with entrepreneurship, there's not always linear feelings about linear progress. So you would expect as an outsider to a business that the more successful it becomes, the more users or customers or whatever metric they're measuring, the more that increases, the better they're going to feel about it. But what people think about less is the level of pressure that comes with that, that every time you hire another staff member, that's another person's income you're responsible for.
And you want to be responsible. You want to be honest and vulnerable and tell people you're not actually having a good day and you need help, whilst at the same time not freaking everyone else out that you've lost your shit and they don't have any confidence in you. And that's always been a really big balancing act.
Yeah.
So that was those sets of experiences, which I feel like, you know, are more understandable because they're mental health problems triggered by experiences or external people. I think the one that I had more recently is what really struck me as very difficult to understand and comprehend. It's a very unusual story because I was raising money for another startup, which was a software company, which I didn't really want to be doing, but I think that has a huge part to play in this. I raised money for a software company. I'd spent time stressed and angry and moody and all this crap, like leading up to the investment round, because when you're an entrepreneur, like all that really matters is you can raise the money so you can hire the people so that you can fulfill the vision that you've promised everyone else and set your ego about doing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did it against the odds is when I was extremely surprised to actually start suffering from proper mental health symptoms. And the reality was, you know, this is going to all sound really show-offy, so forgive me, but this is exactly how I was rationalizing the stuff. It's like, I finally had a home I was really happy with, really great friends, excellent social help. I was engaged to be married in June to my best friend. What else? I had money for the startup that I was like desperate to raise money from. I had a beautiful new office in Shoreditch, which is where I wanted to work. I had all the things. And to make, like, to top it all off, like, I'm not even much of a consumer. It's not like I fuss over having the new this or the new that. It's like, actually, I like things to be pretty simple and I'm generally very easygoing. So the idea that I had all these extra things suddenly and then developed insomnia was bizarre to me. And frankly, I was straight away from raising this money, obviously aware that I had like new responsibilities and that probably had something to do with it. But I mean, I'll be really honest and you can tell me if it's too much, but basically I wasn't able to go to sleep. I was basically wide awake at 11 p.m. and the classic symptoms from insomnia as well, by the way, like in my experience anyway, are like suddenly you're fucking wide awake when you're meant to be going to sleep. It's just unbelievable, but you're so
tired. You almost get into bed and then you wake up more.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's so frustrating. But anyway, so like, you know, 11 o'clock, I'd be suddenly like full of energy again. I'm like, oh God. So the whiskey and the weed would absolutely like really knock me out. But then like clockwork every night, you know, I'd get to sleep at midnight, but then I'd be up 2 a.m. wide awake, like wide awake. And lying in bed is one of the worst things you could do. I mean, I started reading and researching everything about sleep. Now, lying in your bed whilst you're wide awake is actually really bad for your brain association with getting back to sleep, because then you start to associate your bed as the place that you're awake. So I learned that you need to like go into a separate room, a place where you are like more social, like a living room. So I'd end up getting up and starting to work at 2 a.m. So I kind of had nothing else to do. And that just became my nightly routine. Like, honestly, the amount of times my wife would wake up in the middle of the night, well, she's my girlfriend at the time, and be like, where are you? No matter what time it was, I'd just walk into the living room and I'd be there. And she was obviously very surprised. Now, I was doing all the things that, you know, a normal healthy person should do. I was exercising 3 times a week. I was meditating, not every day. I do now, but at the time, if I could remember, here and there. I was eating fairly well, all the things. Had good friends, you know, had a great relationship with my mum, all the stuff, but like, I just couldn't sleep and that was it. And So it was really hard for me. And it was also really kind of awkward for my wife. Like, we have a good laughing relationship over it all, but it's like, you've got insomnia and we're getting married in 4 months, in 3 months, in 2 months. It's like, is it me? It's probably time to like figure that out. I'm like, no. I mean, as far as I'm aware, my acute mental health issues are kind of aside of the fact that I'm really happy to be getting married. You know, the timing was kind of extremely awkward.
And it sounds like something that was very confusing for you at the time, that on paper your life was in a really good place, and yet
that's it. Like,
your health
exactly.
wasn't.
I'm a fairly rational person. I mean, you've kind of pointed this out already, right? I look for sort of strategies or ways to fix things or things to try, but what is there really to try when you feel like you've got everything you ever wanted?
Yeah. And how was the lack of sleep affecting the rest of your life at that point?
Weirdly, you kind of get used to it. So initially, it was kind of all right on the basis of I would just feel dreary all night. But then kind of by the time it was 7 or 8, I'd kind of be chuffed by how much work I'd done. You know, I'd kind of be like, well, hey, it's 8 a.m. and I've already done my whole day's worth of work. Time to do tomorrow's work in the office. Of course, the reality is once you're in the office, you're really sluggish. But then at the same time, it doesn't necessarily matter so much that you're sluggish because you've already done your work. So I guess like I was behaving like it was fine on the basis of I was considering it a productive use of brain power, which is obviously completely inaccurate. And probably all of it was terrible. However, in my mind, I was like, well, you know, it's not so bad. Initially, I mean, eventually it was completely debilitating.
Do you feel like you were rationalizing it at that point to make yourself less worried about it?
Yeah, I didn't really tell anyone that it was happening to me. The only person I really told was my business partner, and I don't think I really told him how bad it was. It was, as in, I'd never said the words I have insomnia. In my experience of all the mental health issues I've ever had, I've only ever really realized after the fact, like a year later when I'm back to normal or whatever I define as normal, that I'm like, oh, that period, well, that was insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I actually just thought I had really bad anxiety, which I did. However, you know, I didn't sleep for 5 months. It's insomnia. Realize on reflection, that's what it was. You know, that's kind of the thing. Like for two or three months, it was okay, manageable. And then it just became completely debilitating. You know, I was obviously slow, exhausted, didn't want to go to the gym and work out anymore. I've always been relatively careful with what I eat after my father, anyway. So that was like an important thing to me. I never really massively, you know, changed up my... I never massively sort of, you know, like... did too much of sort of laying on a sofa eating chocolate bars, but that's only because that comes from like a totally different fear of seeing what happens to someone if they're completely immobile, etc., etc. There's obviously a lot of positives that come out of watching someone's health decline so much in such a way is that you make sure that you're not going to behave that way. But yeah, after a period of time, I mean, all you can do is think about sleep, and ironically, obviously, it's the only thing you definitely can't do.
And so was there a clear turning point for you?
Yeah, it was a very surprising one, but basically I was telling a friend of mine about my symptoms, and I told her I've tried all the things. Of course, I hadn't tried all the things. For example, I hadn't gone to a therapist, so I certainly hadn't tried all the things. I just tried all the things from an arrogant man's point of view. But I was telling her, and she basically bought me this book on brain nutrition. And she was like, have you tried changing your diet? And I was like, no, but like I have a pretty good diet, so I don't really feel like blah, 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 blah. She was like, well, just read this book. It's amazing. And she had had mental health issues, different ones, but someone had given her this book. And, you know, it was all like used, torn at the edges and all that kind of stuff. But I was like, okay, fine, why not? I mean, frankly, at this point, I'll try anything. But I did. I read it and I became really interested. And
you remember what the book is called?
Oh, yeah, of course. I've got it pride of place in my office. It's called Optimum Nutrition for the Mind.
Okay.
It's by a nutritionist called Patrick Holford, and he's been doing nutrition for 40 plus years. So he has 40 books. And the book is great. It's really interesting, much more engaging than my idea of what I thought a nutrition book would be, and very practical. And so that's kind of the thing, is that it clearly outlined why fish and eggs were so important for your brain's health, what happens to your brain with micronutrient imbalance when you're not getting enough of these things. And it pointed out from his experience as an ex-vegan, something that doesn't happen to everyone, but can happen to some people, is the fact your brain is an organ. It needs two things more than anything, which is hydration and food. And the third thing is obviously sleep. So it kind of stands to reason that if you're dehydrated massively, or you're not getting the right nutrients in, you're probably not going to sleep. You know, it's like a kind of cascading logic that once someone says it to you, you're kind of like, oh yeah, that kind of does make a lot of sense. And your brain is 60% fat. So it's actually pretty simple what kind of stuff it needs. It's not overly complicated. It's not, you know, a ridiculously complicated thing to comprehend or grasp. And cut a long story short, within 2 weeks, I was sleeping until 5 a.m. 5 p.m. would be unbelievable.
That'd be some switch.
Well, my God, mate, I would be so happy if I could even pull that off now. Anyway, no, I was sleeping till 5 a.m. And then within a month, I was sort of sleeping to a normal time, which was 7. You know, and I was like, that's amazing. That's like back to normal. And then basically, I was committing to carrying on doing that. And since, you know, since that all started to get better, you know, I've stopped smoking weed, fortunately. I've cut down my drinking massively because I've become very interested in how it can affect your sleep. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you have a lot of your sleep affected, then your mental health is going to suffer to some degree anyway. So that's been like another thing that's been interesting, is sort of like the winding down of those crutches that I used as well to kind of get back on my own support system slowly but surely. It's not like I feel like I could cut everything all at once. You know, it took a little while, but...
Yeah, but I think you've highlighted there how it can be the simplest things that set your mental health onto a recovery route, that in improving certain things about your lifestyle, you were able to increase your sleep, and then when you're getting more sleep, it kind of had this knock-on effect that your mental health got better in general. You know, no doubt it had a really positive effect on your anxiety levels and bringing those down as well.
Absolutely. You know, look, at the end of the day, sleep is just everything. right? Genuinely, we're learning more and more about sleep as we get on. You know, there's such a stigma attached to, you know, sort of bro culture of like a little amount that people can sleep. You know, like, oh, I can get by on just like 5 or 6 hours. It's like, that's great. But actually, the science behind it all says that's not even a good thing. Like, we should be sleeping 7 to 8 hours.
Absolutely.
All the science and evidence says that. So we kind of need to destigmatize sleeping like it's a bad thing. And actually, sleeping and naps are like incredibly good for us. And so we should be optimizing them. And when you can't do one of them, no matter how much you want to do it, that is obviously going to affect your own perspective of your own mortality.
Yeah, for sure. Because there is this pressure in our 24-hour lifestyles to almost behave like a robot. And of course, that affects our mental health because we're not robots. We need sleep. Sleep is the thing that we should be spending the most time doing compared to any other individual task. And that's for very good reason.
And it is the most freely available source of good mental health that is available to anyone in the world. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't cost anything. Everyone can do it, in theory.
Yeah, right? In theory.
Is there a tool? Yeah, exactly. Is there as a tool? So if you can do it, you should be optimizing it. And
for
if you can't, you should be trying the different things that help you get back to it.
Absolutely. And so we are at the end of our time almost. So we'll round up there.
Sorry.
No, it's been...
Definitely rambled on.
Not to worry. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And so I think this conversation leads quite well into how your interest in nutrition and how the brain works led into the business that you run now.
Absolutely. From that point on, I basically decided that this was the area for me. I guess I became totally fascinated, almost blown away by the idea that A, this had had an impact on me, B, that someone introducing the idea of brain nutrition to me had been such a surprising piece of information to someone who generally considered themselves very health conscious. It had still never really entered my sphere of consciousness in the first place. And so I started writing a newsletter on better brain health, which I have been sending for now 45 weeks. So it's coming up to a year. Every Sunday, I send something research from the science journals about better brain health. So a tool or a tactic or a tip that's scientifically proven how it can impact your life, do with your brain. My understanding of the brain of people in general is if they understand their brain better, they might be able to operate better in general. So the idea is to research the science journal, share it in fun and plain English every Sunday with a recipe of the week, which is on brain nutrition, which is literally something you can cook that's full of nutrients. And then the product that we're developing and have been for the last year is ultimately a multivitamin for the brain. Because when I was looking at multivitamins, they didn't have the things in that actually were required for your brain. And that seemed very silly to me. So the only way really to get good brain nutrients to give people free information. And actually, I ended up reaching out to that author of that book to come on board and help me develop the product. And he obviously initially ignored me like I was a weird fan. But, you know, I was very persistent. And he's been part of the project ever since, like helping us develop that in the background. And since then, we've brought on board a chief science officer who's a neuroscientist who has a PhD in neurological pharmacology. And she's absolutely brilliant. So it's been very exciting to sort of bring her onto the team and actually have a brain expert work on the product development with us. So that product launches at the end of the year. But until then, our newsletter is sent every Sunday and it's free. And it shares tips for better brain health. And I guess, you know, this is an interesting way to end our conversation is that I haven't looked back. I've been adopting an eating a brain first diet ever since. And I really enjoy sharing that kind of stuff with people every single week.
Great. And so if people want to sign up to the newsletter, where should they go online?
That is a great question. They should go to heights.co. So that's heights.co.
Great. All right, I'll link that in the description for this episode as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
Cool.
Cheers, man.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.